A lot of people like the idea of entrepreneurship, and then when you get into it and you realize how grinding it is and how different it is than a normal, you know, 9-to-5 job, that's where, you know, that's where the wheat gets separated from the tares, because it's really a different kind of demand than most people understand.
Well, Clayton Mask, welcome to the show, man. Glad to have you.
Hey, great to be here with you, Nick.
So we've known each other for a long time.
Yes.
Done quite a few things together in the past. You know, I think I want to start off with, you know, you've had your own interesting entrepreneurial journey. One of the things that I think people don't talk about nearly enough, I do think Gino Wickman did a great job in his book, Entrepreneurial Leap, of distinguishing whether entrepreneurship is right for you or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think those of us who are entrepreneurs have this tendency to think it's the only way. Although as we become wiser, we realize the world would be nowhere if it was all entrepreneurs.
Right.
Like, it definitely takes a balance of everyone.
Right.
And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on a bit of, you know, as you've been on the entrepreneurial journey. We're going to talk about all sorts of things, but I think this first thing, you've worked with so many entrepreneurs. What do you think is important when people are trying to figure out, you know, if they're an entrepreneur or not, should they start a business? You don't have to be an entrepreneur to start a business. You just might need someone with entrepreneurial tendencies. Like, what have you learned about entrepreneurship and who is it right for and who is it wrong for in some of your journey?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question. You know, I think that a lot of people like the idea of entrepreneurship, and then when you get into it and you realize how grinding it is and how different it is than a normal, you know, 9-to-5 job, that's where, you know, that's where the wheat gets separated from the tares, because it's really a different kind of demand than most people understand. So I think the rigors of what's required to be an entrepreneur, and it's a different kind of rigor, as you know, it's something where you've got to kind of always have it in your mind. Unfortunately, it's just always there. And so if you don't like that, then, and you can't handle that, then it's probably not going to be the best thing for you, because you can't just turn it on and off. It's not like that as an entrepreneur. You're thinking about it all the time. And so I think that for entrepreneurs who for people who like the idea of entrepreneurship, but they're not willing to really go with the grind of it and stick through it and go through the ups and downs, the tough times. I mean, it's said all the time, you have to have a different level of grit and tenacity and persistence as an entrepreneur. So if you're the type of person that gets easily deterred when you encounter obstacles, then don't do entrepreneurship. You got no chance.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So, I mean, it seems like, I guess many things in life are a discipline, but the more I learn about running a business, being an entrepreneur, and by the way, I would say this, like, I'm an entrepreneur and I don't run my business. Like, mm-hmm. That's a big difference.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sort of the CEO. So the visionary, if you will, you know, if we're using EOS language, but I think that's really important. Like, most people, when they start out doing things, and especially if you have entrepreneurial tendencies, like as a kid, you probably, whether you mow lawns or whatever, like, you do it all, right? You, like, mm-hmm. you talk to the neighbors, you put out the flyers, you do the pressure washing, you collect the money, you try to get them to rebook, you do the lawn, like, you do everything. And my biggest secret to having, you know, any success at all is learning to stay in my lane, like,
yeah.
learning that there's no ego and me not running my business. I mean, it's way better for everybody. And some entrepreneurs do have operational tendencies and habits too.
Yeah.
I feel like it's less often than not, but mm-hmm. maybe I'm wrong mm-hmm. on that.
But yeah. I see it both ways. You know, I see some people who they really are in the day-to-day of it and they love that. You know, it's a huge part of what drives them and brings them satisfaction. And I see other people who are more about kind of staying above it all and seeing the overall, the overall success of the operation, and they don't need to be in the operation. And so, yeah. You know, it's different flavors of entrepreneurship, and the more capital you have, the more you can be the latter. The more, you know, because it takes capital usually to get that going and to be able to, and so a lot of times you'll see successful serial entrepreneurs that are creating many businesses, but they're not running them. They have right. people that are running them, but they get themselves into that position by virtue of the capital position they've been able to get into. So when you don't have that capital, then you've got to operate a little bit more in the day to day. And so, you know, you've got to learn how to do that flavor of entrepreneurship if you don't have capital. And that's where it really comes down to. You better learn how to sell. You better learn how to effectively communicate the value of what you offer to the world. And if you can't do that, then you're not going to be successful.
Yeah. And you start to learn also that, you know, of course, look, everyone starts out at the lowest levels of like whatever your idea is, you know, trying to enroll friends, family to help and all that stuff, but doing everything. But you pretty quickly realize, I mean, one of the first big roadblocks is time is even a more precious capital than money
right,
is, right?
Right.
And so this work-life balance, tell me about when you felt like you first started maybe feeling the pull of this work-life balance and how am I going to figure this out? And then, you know, I have my own story about how I dealt with it, but how did you handle that?
Yeah. Boy, you're dead on. And the interesting thing is what I found is you feel that pull of work-life balance at different stages as the business grows, and you kind of figure it out at one stage, and then you have to reinvent yourself, pull back, stop doing certain things. But I remember, you know, when the business was about, we were doing a couple million in annual revenue. We just had our fifth child. You know, life was really busy, and trying to do it all just felt impossible. And there just weren't enough hours in the day. And I remember there were two significant things that I did at that point. The first one was I got into a coaching relationship that helped me to start to take a step back and see things that I needed to let go of. You know, as I said, kind of reinvent my role. And the second thing is we started to just put a lot more automation in place. And, you know, that, as you know, I mean, obviously that's what we do at Keep, is we help people buy back their time with automation. And that point that you make, you're exactly right. In entrepreneurship, especially when you're more in the operating side of things, there aren't enough hours in the day. And so you've got to find ways to both get out of ineffective activities that you've been doing and get other people doing them. And then also, you know, get software to do some of that for you through automation.
Yeah. I think one of the blessings that I had was I grew up, let's say, in music, and I started, you know, producing records and doing stuff from like 16, 18, started at 16 there, like making my own records in my room, and then went to college and had a recording studio, worked with some Grammy winners. And I had the blessing very early of realizing how much I sucked at certain things. Like, you know, I could make a song on my own, but it was like, you know, it's sort of this natural, it's really interesting. Like, there aren't many successful one man bands, right? Yeah. Like, there's a couple, like Ed Sheeran can hold a stadium by himself, right? That with looping and all the things he does. But sort of the beauty of it is like, yeah, I mean, I could play a little bit of drums, I could play a little bit of keyboard, but if I wanted to sound good, I just, you know, entice my friend, whether it was by buying him beers or, you know, trying to give him a meal or just saying, I'll owe you a favor, I'll do something for you later. But like, you know, it was a really easy thing for me to realize, you know, I mean, I've been playing guitar since I was six, so I'm almost 40 years. Mm. And I actually was just in Nashville yesterday, and I mean, I could never play guitar as well as this guy and like millions of other people. I just realized, you know what? There's no ego in me going, I'm just not going to play on this. I'm just going to hire someone who's great to do it. So I think I learned pretty early on that, you know, teamwork is an amazing thing, and you don't have to worry. You got to find a resource or a way to barter or whatever to do it. But you do need help. I'd say too, my thing was when I had my second, there's like two of the roadblocks that I'm thinking of. Like when I was, my second son was born, I had just started the business. Like, I just started this sort of this version of business January of 07. I had other businesses in college and stuff, like my first big boy business. And he was born in October of 07. And we had another one that had been born in 05. And this second one, Bowen, was he's colicky, man. He just had colic. And I just remember the first 12 weeks of his life, I thought, I don't know how you ever, I mean, with most babies, you do that anyway. And this was like a, like just cry all night. So I remember my wife would like take the shift. I'd take the shift to like 3 a.m. and I just keep working. Mm-hmm. And then she'd take like the 3 to like 8 a.m. Then I'd get up and help a little bit. Then I'd have to go, you know, back to when we went to offices and stuff.
Yeah.
I'd go do all that. And I realized pretty quickly there that like I had to do what it took. But number one, you know, thankfully I was 27 at the time. I had lots of energy. I still do, but I don't have that level anymore. And I realized like this is not going to be healthy long term. So I'm going to need help. I just can't do all the sales all day and all the work at night. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
And then number two, I remember it seems like a decade ago, I'm bad with dates, but I started, you know, getting successful, you know, in speaking and then also in the documentary world. And I was songwriting still. And my wife's like, hey, look, I know you got to make money for the family, but I did not sign up to do this alone. And together we worked through it and we came up with a sort of a guardrail, some rules, right? Like 7 nights a month is what I was able to travel. And if I was going to be gone for dinner, that counted as half a night because at the time the kids were doing a lot of stuff,
right.
But we really did get to sit down most nights for family dinner, which if anyone's ever looked at the research for that, it's super important.
Yep.
I can't even imagine 5, you know, and over the years, you know, I've had to negotiate for an extra night here, an extra night there, whatever, but it's made it really, to me, it's a big part of the success of an entrepreneur who's actually growing a business is figuring out, you know, recognizing what your weaknesses are. And actually, in a lot of ways, I think probably searching out what your weaknesses are, because, you know, until you find those and then until you put some guardrails on your time and your family time or whatever it is that's important to you, if you don't, we've all seen the opposite side of that. Now, I know you through working other businesses and then growing Keep, which started out as some name I never heard of and then became Infusionsoft and then became Keep, you know, you've grown through a lot of different levels of, fundraising and tech and all that sort of stuff. Through all that, you wrote a book called Conquer the Chaos, hit the New York Times bestseller list. You re-released it recently. I'd love to talk a little bit about what the main principles of Conquer the Chaos are.
Yeah.
And then since you released it, what, over a decade ago, I think it is, what have you learned or what did you update in the book that you think is really relevant to today?
Yeah, you bet. I'd love to talk about that. For, you know, first of all, I appreciate your point about some of the things that you needed to do to find balance with your family, you know, the example of working, you know, working with your wife and helping a colicky baby and then figuring out that important family time that, you know, it can't be missed. And I especially appreciate your point that missing a dinner is worth half a day gone. That's a really great way to say it. Charisse and I established pretty early on that there's a morning routine and there's a night routine. And when dad's gone for one of those, it causes problems. So it's not, you know, it's not a sustainable thing for dad to miss those consistently. And so we got really disciplined about that in a similar way that you did. And we had kind of travel and we didn't get it right down to the math that you described, but we had a similar approach. It was like, well, look, you're going to be gone this many nights this month out of town, but look how many nights you have a function or a morning breakfast with somebody. And so, you know, I just had to say no to a lot of things in order to make it work. And you know, one of my favorite learnings is that, and I got this in a visceral way, you know, just it's really hit me personally one time that there's so many people, especially as you grow and you start to achieve more success, there's so many people that want to have lunch with you, or, you know, go to coffee or pick your brain about this or that. And, you know, I genuinely enjoy the conversations with entrepreneurs. And so I was inclined to say yes to a lot of things. And the thing that I learned was every time I say yes to someone else, I'm saying no to my family. And so I made a prioritization with my coach on who can have access to my time and the priority of it. And it made it really, practical to, you know, to be able to identify those things that would pull me away from family. And I prioritized my family and then my team members, the direct reports, and then my employees, and then, you know, friends, you know, and unfortunately, yeah, friends, you know, when you're growing fast and you're going through all the stuff you're going through, your friends have to get behind your team and your employees, because that's, you know, you got to prioritize them. And then, you know, you have friends and family extended family members, and then, you know, it kind of goes after that, and you get to a point where it's like, well, I don't have time. I can't say yes to these things, because I'm saying no to my family or to my team. And I think having a really simple response for people that enables you to stick to that principle is valuable. I have an email template I've probably sent out. I mean, I've sent it out hundreds of times when people ask to meet with me, and I just say, man, I would love to meet with you. I love talking with entrepreneurs. But I've learned that every time I say yes to something like this, I'm saying no to my family or my team. And so I'm not going to do that. Let's pretend we're at lunch or coffee or whatever it was they asked. Let's pretend we're there. What would you like to talk about? And, you know, in almost about half the time they'll reply and say, wow, I really respect your response. I'm going to do something similar. And then, you know, sometimes they don't respond, and most of the time they respond and they ask what they would have asked if we'd gotten together. And I can very efficiently route that to somebody else or give them a resource or something like that. So, you know, just a simple practice that I've found is really, really useful. And in being able to say no, and then just being able to live with yourself. Because a lot of times, you know, we feel kind of bad about saying no to people that we really care about or that we would like to meet with, but you have to get past that. You know, we all know the famous Warren Buffett quote: the difference between successful and super successful people is that super successful people say no to almost everything. And that's
valid points. Yeah, I think, and here's the thing I love about this. Number one, I love the fact that you talk about, you know, you were running a, you know, a multi seven figure business, and what really helped you was your coach. Like, I don't sell coaching or anything, but I think, man, that sort of outside perspective is everything.
Super valuable.
When you're in the middle of seeing this stuff, when you're in the middle of doing this stuff, particularly for the first time, I mean, it just feels like you're making it all up as you go, yeah. And you're not doing it efficiently.
Yeah.
Like, 9 out of 10 times. And someone who's done it before, or even just someone who can sit from the outside, that's has some wisdom to them. You don't want to listen to everybody.
Right.
People have some wisdom. You definitely don't want to listen to somebody who doesn't have much life experience, and though they're glad to charge you. And, you know, there's many in that industry, but when, you know, someone who has wisdom and says, hey, let's take a step back and look at it, because when you're in it, you're in it. And there's a reason you're in it. I mean, you built a business because you're probably pretty good at being in it on some level.
I
love that. So coaching and an outside perspective.
Yep.
And the other thing is this, what I love talking to, you know, on this podcast, people, because your answer to this question is going to be different to mine, going to be different to everyone's. Like, mm-hmm. One of the things that I hate that people do, actually, I use Dan Kennedy a lot as an example of this. I call it like the three phases of Dan Kennedy. So when you learn there's this guy who's a curmudgeon that sits in his basement, takes home multi seven figures a year, direct bottom line with basically no staff. He does not have internet. Only has a landline and a fax machine, no cell phone, and he will call you when he wants to talk to you. And if you want to meet with him, you got to fly to the middle of nowhere and pay, you know, 18, 20, I don't even know the number now, 25 grand to sit in a basement with him. And that's how he operates. And he basically makes money writing for a living, sales letters, not books.
Right.
I mean, he has books too. Like, phase one is there's no way. Like, that is not even possible. Then when people start to like get into like what they call Planet Dan, sort of the world, and learn more about him, what most of us do is we decide that, oh my gosh, I would love to make that kind of income. So why don't I become Dan Kennedy? And I've seen so many people like cancel their cell phone, get rid of the internet, get a basement, get rid of all their friends, you know, whatever it is that they do that Dan would do. And then they realize like, oh my God, I'm miserable. Like, this is not for me. And then, so what is it? Then they integrate like, okay, maybe I don't need to be, you know, whatever the thing is, available to all my clients 24/7. Maybe I don't need to be, maybe the internet and some social media stuff is just a distraction here or there, maybe whatever. Mm-hmm. But I love the fact that that's a system that works for you. The system works for me is different. What I want everyone to do, the whole point of this podcast is, you know, a better quality of life in every facet is had by asking better questions, by a better quality of questions.
Yeah.
So what you should be doing here is listening and saying, okay, I see that works for Clay. Like, what would work for me? What would be, you know, authentic to me? What would be authentic for my family or those who I love, but also, you know, also inspire me? Like, so for me, I get most of my creative inspiration from having tons of outside conversations. Mm-hmm. So if I cut the, like, I have to be careful the ones that I take, much like you, but I have to leave elbow room to have those random conversations, or I rarely will learn the thing I need to know, like, to finish the next film in a way I never could have done it, however. And that's what works for me. I love the fact that we all have different systems, and it really is about what works for you and what works for your family. We've both seen so many entrepreneurs who are supremely gifted at whatever their specialty is. Yet, you know, I remember there's one very well-known speaker. I won't say his name for obvious reasons, but he was doing this big motivational speech. And then I remember there's like this Rascal Flatts ballad was playing over the top of it. And he's showing all these pictures of his jet and his lifestyle and his home. And it gets to the picture of his kids and his two kids. Like, they're teenagers, which teenagers are a bit of a different animal, but you've had them, I've had them. They weren't miserable in my house. Like, we still have a good relationship. Right. And these kids look like they would rather, eat worms than be in this picture with their dad. Like, he's got like his arm around him, and they're both like, and you know, it just was the most visceral example I've ever seen of someone who was really gifted at one thing, but really, at least in my value system, you know, forgot about what really matters. Mm-hmm. And we see it all the time. So I think the point here really is, you know, asking the questions of who do I want to be to who first?
Yeah.
But I also have obligations. Like, look, we can all look when it proverbially hits the fan, like when a COVID happens, look, we do whatever we got to do. Right. I mean, I think you still have to ask important questions to make sure your family's okay or whatever, but in a crisis or the mortgage meltdown, the housing crisis. I mean, sometimes you got to change the rules just to eat, just to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. And you might be listening to this in a phase where you're in a startup or you've had a bankruptcy, or like, there are times in everyone's life where you just have to do what you just have to do. We all acknowledge that. We've all been there. However, as you start to gain some momentum, which momentums are the hardest things to gain, as you start to gain some of that momentum, I think what Clayton and I would both like you to see, as people who, you know, you're further ahead than I am, you're a grandpa, but, you know, I got great relationships with my kids, and they're 19 and 16 and 13. And, awesome. You know, it's great. And I know you do too. And people are always like, I was so afraid because so many entrepreneurs would tell me like, oh, just wait till they're teenagers. I'm like, and now I'm like, it's not that different. I mean, you know, they got raging hormones and stuff, but I do too.
Yep.
It's just communicating. Like, my kids have never, people are like, man, your kids look so happy. I'm like, well, they are. Cause like, I never pulled the rug out from under them. I just told them from day one what was expected of them.
Yeah.
And if we have an issue, we talk about it. Like, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
I know you've done the same.
Totally. I had a guy that, you know, when my kids were little, I think the oldest was about 10 at the time. And he's about 10 years older than me, 15 years older than me. And he said something like, well, enjoy it now. You know, they're not going to like you for a long time. And I was like, you know, okay, well, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe it'll be different, you know? And
yeah,
and it was different. You know, I mean, of course, kids get upset at times, but I would say that, no, you can raise teenagers and in a way that is really great and fun, and they like you. And yeah, you get in arguments at time, and you know, guess what? They don't like it when you ask them to take the trash out. We'll get over it.
Right.
I wouldn't like it either if someone asked me to do something that I didn't want to do. It's a little bit about what you expect is what you get in terms of raising teenagers. And if you expect that it's going to be great, then you're going to get great.
Yeah. And I think it's so much of it too is like, we know this, but you can't, some people are shocked that they basically don't give their child much guidance. And then when they're 12 or 13, they start trying to give them guidance. Like, that's not, doesn't typically work out real well.
Right.
This really comes in, Clay, in the book, Conquering the Chaos. Everyone should check it out.
Yeah.
One thing that you talk about is, we just talked, I think, a lot about, well, you talked about achievements in work-life balance with automation and systems that apply themselves even better. Number two, transitioning from survival to growth. We talked a little bit about that. Like, you just do what you got to do till you start getting going. And then one of the first things you should start doing is figuring out automation as well as others, whether it's part-time or consultants or employees or partners, however you want to do that, but other people who can help you, you know, to start managing growth instead of just survival. What I think we're talking about now really is sort of practical application. And one of the big things, we're talking a lot about values. And I think so many people don't realize that the whole secret to all of this is building a business around your values. Like that's,
yeah,
like people try to do that sometimes way too late.
Yep.
When what I think people don't realize is when you start a business as an entrepreneur and you typically are, you're either the only one or at the very least the face of it. Let's even say you're, you know, you and I are both attorneys, right? So you might have an assistant at first, but really they're mostly interfacing with you.
Mm-hmm.
But as you grow your business, if you don't build those, if you aren't clear on what those values are and build those values into the operations of the business, you lose the magic of why people would hire you in the first place.
Right.
But when you build in those values, you build in you. So people have the same experience more or less working with you as they do with working with people who are a good culture fit and good value fit. Where do you think people should start, or do you, what's your process for, what was your process for building your values into your business? And then how it's like many of the things we talk about, you don't just do it once and stop.
Yeah.
It's like a constant auditing of it to make sure it's still authentic.
Yeah, for sure. You know, before I talk about the values, let me just kind of address directly the question you asked a little earlier when you said, hey, well, what's the book? What's it about? You know, what did you revise? The original edition of Conquer the Chaos was 14 years ago. And we wrote it when we were introducing marketing automation to the world. And last year, I decided, you know what, a lot has changed. I want to do a revised edition. I thought it would be about 20% different. It ended up being about 90% different. I almost completely rewrote the book. And I was surprised, but I fell in love with the project because I love entrepreneurs. And what really drove me on this was to, and I've seen the dark side of entrepreneurship, as I call it in the book. I've seen how it the business can consume the entrepreneur, even when the business is very successful. It's not just when it's struggling, but it'll consume a successful business will consume the entrepreneur because of it's intoxicating. People get addicted to it. It becomes so, you know, it becomes their.
It's engrossing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I hate to put it in a very blunt way, but it becomes their mistress in some ways, you know. And so, you get so intoxicated and so enveloped in the business. And that's when it's successful. And then there are times where it's struggling. And as we all know, it's not like it's either, you know, everything's great or everything's rough. It goes in between. So you're on this roller coaster and the business can dominate your life and crowd out everything else. And so what I've seen is that if we aren't more intentional about the way we build businesses and more balanced in the approach, then we have a lot of regrets. And I've seen that with so many friends. And I've flirted with it myself. I've you know, come up against it many times over the course of the last 2+ decades. And so because we get to serve entrepreneurs, and I see so many small businesses, I see so many entrepreneurs, I've got a vantage point that I felt like, no, I just have to share essentially what I wish I could have read in a book 20 years ago. And so that's what the book is. It's Conquer the Chaos, the 6 keys to success for entrepreneurs. And the 6 keys are broken into the first 3, which are personal keys, and the second 3, which are business keys. And the personal keys, and this starts to go to your second question of, well, where do you start? You have to start with your personal values. And so the 3 personal keys are mindset, vision, and not vision for your business, vision for your life. So mindset, vision, and rhythm of execution. So in other words, how do you execute this vision that you have in a not in a habitual way. Habits cause routines and ruts. Rhythm is music. It's magic. It creates flow. It creates an energy. It's really exciting. And so on the personal side, it's mindset, vision, and rhythm. And of course, habit and discipline get integrated into that. But I was very intentional about rhythm, not routine and rut. You know, that a lot of entrepreneurs will buck that, but when they find a rhythm that's just fun to execute, you love doing it, then it's amazing, and you're executing your life vision. So when you get the personal side set up with a mindset for success and a life vision and a rhythm of execution, then you can create a business that fits that and that actually feeds that mindset, vision, and rhythm, and it starts to become a virtuous cycle. The business keys to success are strategy, automation, and leadership. And when you practice those 3 business keys along with the 3 personal keys, it starts to become really powerful because the 3 business keys are improving the personal side and the personal side is improving the business side. And so it's, you know, that's why I call it conquer the chaos. Running a small business can be chaos. And if entrepreneurs don't have an intentional way to do it, then they end up having regrets. And, you know, at the beginning of the book, I say, look, these are the six keys to success for entrepreneurs, according to Clay. And my definition of success is balanced growth in your business and personal life that produces freedom. So if entrepreneurs want balanced growth in business and personal life that produces freedom, growth in the business, growth in your income, growth in your impact to customers, growth in, you know, all of that. But then on the personal side, growth in your personal growth and development, your mindset, who you're able to become and who you're able to serve and how you're able to live your life on your terms. And, you know, all of those things, that's the balanced growth that produces freedom that I hope for entrepreneurs.
That's great. And it also, actually, as we talked about, I was thinking about it, you know, there's many different phases from startup to your first 100 grand and then your first million and then, you know, 3 to 5 million and then over 5 and over 10, like it becomes a different sort of monster at each phase. If you don't manage it, it actually goes right back to sort of like, it'd be like raising a kid and feeding it really well, mm-hmm. but not teaching it any manners, right? Like you gotta raise it. And then you do oftentimes turn around and go, oh, wait a minute. Like I've been so dedicated to this one thing I had to execute on. It looks different now and I'm going to need some help or I need to find a way to do that. I know, you know, during the pandemic, we had never had like a CFO and we didn't need a full-time CFO, but we ended up finding a fractional CFO who made everything make so much sense. Like I was able to basically run the business for over a decade on like, you know, a glorified version of like the envelope system I learned from my mom, right? Mm-hmm. Like tithe here, savings here, right. Whatever. But, you know, eventually we had like, I don't know, like 28 bank accounts and like a million Excel spreadsheets. She's like, let me just show you a simpler way.
Yeah.
And I was a little uncomfortable with it at first because it just was so different than what I just had done my whole life. But I brought him in because I didn't know what to do next.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how these different phases of the business, just when you think you sort of have a handle on it, with the blessing of growth or sometimes the blessing of just change that you didn't even ask for, like things start to look differently. How do you, I'm sure you probably pretty inherently just innately recognize those things, but any advice to people who feel like they're starting to get to a phase like that and what do they do next?
Yes. I call it the stages of small business growth, and the stages change on the ones and threes of revenue. 100,000, 300,000, 1 million, 3 million, 10 million, 30 million, 100 million. It's a law of business. It's crazy. I've studied this for years and years and years. I tore apart the Census Bureau data. I watched our customers. I've observed for 15 years. It's actually one of the main reasons why that drove me to write Conquer the Chaos in the first place 14 years ago, as I was watching the patterns of growth of our customers. And Scott and I got to the point where we could predict what was coming. We're like, well, we see what's next for this customer. Like it's pretty obvious. And I, as I really studied it, I got down to some really interesting and fascinating discoveries. And one of those discoveries was that the stages change at the ones and threes of revenue. And the second discovery is that, and you know, people inherently understand that, or sort of innately understand that business doesn't grow in a smooth upward trajectory. It grows in stair-step fashion. But what we don't realize is that the plateaus on the stair steps are happening because we hit the next stage, but we're not making the changes in our people, process, and systems. And sometimes our product. So sometimes you got to make a product adjustment as well to get through to the next stage. So when you realize that, oh, I'm going through a stage change. And I write about this in the book, the stages of small business growth and the ones and threes of revenue. There's things you have to do with your people, your process, your products. And if you don't do those things, you're going to prolong your stay in that stage. And by the way, some people are fine. They're, you know, I don't want to move past the next stage. But most of the time when they're honest with themselves, it's because they don't know how to get to the next stage without it looking like, you know, in an undesirable way. Oh, well, I don't want to have all those employees because then I got these problems. Or, well, I don't want. Well, right. It's just because you're not designing the next stage with intentionality that serves your life.
Yeah, I was taught from many sources, and I think it's just because it was not their talent, which I understand. But I had this bias that like employees were the worst thing ever. Mm-hmm. And at one time I went to lunch with a friend of mine from church who's a pediatrician who just I really admired. She's a really healthy family and just a guy who just, man, he's just such a cool guy. Does great trips with his family, has a great practice. Like, just, you know, he would make time for parents at the pediatric practice, which is really rare, right? I mean, yeah. It's usually just like in, zip, zip, shot, shot, gone. I mean, sometimes he'd make he'd schedule an appointment without one of my kids there just to speak with us if we had concerns. Like, I just really admired how intentional he was. Mm-hmm. And I went to lunch with him one time, and he started talking about what a blessing he felt like it was to have all these team members at work for him. I'm like, what are you talking about? Right. I've heard it's a curse. Mm-hmm. He's like, no. Like, yo, and again, I have no problem expressing my faith. Whatever yours is, whoever, I know yours too, Clay, but like, sure, whoever's listening, if that's not your language, it's okay. But think it's still applicable. He basically was saying, look, like, you've been given certain gifts, like, other people have been given other gifts, and they're symbiotic, man. Your job, like, part of the reason you were given this gift is to help bless other people's lives. Right. So, like, how cool is it that you can create something that you want to create, and they'll help you with it, and you can help them have a great life and have a family and own a home and buy cars and go to dinner? Like, I'm like, oh, man, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, since I changed my mindset on that, it's been, you know, we've built in the culture and the values of just having a great team of people who work together to achieve the goals and the vision we all set. And man, what an incredible way to build something. You can't build it by yourself. You just can't.
Right. That's exactly right. And that comes right back around to the question you asked of how do you build your values in and create an amazing culture? And it does start with the mindset and the philosophy of the entrepreneur. If the entrepreneur views employees as a necessary evil, you'll never create an amazing culture. They'll always be working for you and your interests instead of working for a co-created vision that they feel like is theirs, that they take ownership in. And it's so ironic because what we all want as entrepreneurs is employees who treat the customers the way we would, who love the business the way we do, who are passionate and it comes through loud and clear in their interactions and the quality of their work and the details that they, you know, that they pay attention to. Well, that happens as you make them stakeholders in the business, as you make them co-creators and co-owners of the business. So you don't have to necessarily give financial co-ownership, although profit sharing or something like that is a really great way to do it. But give them ownership and responsibility, make them a part of it, make them feel that it's their company as well. And then all of a sudden you get to participate in something that is, it takes a ton of weight off of you. It brings you a bunch of satisfaction to see people doing things that you couldn't do and like bringing out their unique ability, their specialty in something that you can't do. And it actually, for me, it's one of the things that inspires me the most is seeing what our employees do that I could never do. And it's just a lot of fun. So I subscribe to the same theory as your pediatrician friend. And what I would say, and I write about this in the book, in Leadership, all you need to do is get very intentional about your purpose, your values, and your mission. And when you're very clear about your purpose, which is why you exist as a company, and then you get very clear about 3 to 7 values. More than 7 is too many. People can't live them. Fewer than 3 is not enough. You haven't defined enough. But 3 to 7 core values, and this is how you operate. So the purpose is why, the core values is how we operate, how we conduct ourselves around here. And then the mission. And the mission is a very discrete, specific 3 years, usually for small businesses. It can be as long as 5 or even 10 for bigger companies, but a mission that you're up to that is like, we're going to accomplish this by this, you know, by this time with these indicators of success. And we are on, it's like a military mission. We are going to make this happen. When you hire and coach and fire to a well-articulated purpose, values, and mission, you've got the makings of a really amazing culture. And then you just work on it every day to reinforce it through your practices and through your hiring, coaching, and firing.
You talk about all those things in the book, obviously, but you know, when it comes to creating core values and aligning with these things, are there any, like we use at the size of our business, we use EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System. Is there a system that you recommend that you like for that?
Yeah. So we learned, I'll give a little background on this. When we got really intentional about this 15, 20 years ago, I went and studied everything I could and I found everything. And probably Jim Collins' stuff was the most valuable. He wrote a book called Beyond Entrepreneurship, the first edition of it. I encouraged him to write a second edition, which he ended up doing, and I got to help out a little bit on that. But the first edition, chapter two, is probably the best summary of kind of the ethos of doing, of creating this. And then we practiced it for a long time and actually had a bunch of our customers say, hey, we want you to teach us that. Long story short, we spun out a little company that teaches this. It's called Elite Entrepreneurs. You can go to growwithelite.com to see the practices of how you do this. And then in the book, in leadership, I talk about it and I give some tools for people. But that leadership key to success is really one of the main aspects of it is co-create your purpose, values, mission, hire a coach and fire to it.
Love it. And again, just remind everybody, Conquer the Chaos, here with Clayton Mask. Check out the new version of the book. It's the old one was great, but the new one's greater. We talk a little bit about leadership too in the book, because at some point you can never continue to grow and fully actualize your vision without becoming a great leader and developing a great leadership team. You can't do it all on your own.
Right.
Tell us about some of the things you've learned over the years of growing your company, and maybe tell us a little bit about where you guys are at, like size wise right now and stuff. Cause I know that you guys have, you've been a behemoth at times.
Yeah.
I'm sure as times change, you probably shrink and grow like other businesses do, but yeah, share where you're at now.
Yeah, totally. And you said it a little earlier when you were talking, the key in leadership and your role in evolution as a company or as a leader is that you said something like, you've actually got to look for your weaknesses. You got to try to find them. You know, there's a simple saying that's do what you do best and delegate the rest. And that process is a quest. Like, you're always working on finding what you do best and delegating the rest. I think, you know, I'm a big subscriber to Dan Sullivan's unique ability concept, where you find what you do uniquely well, and then you, the evolution of the business is you're just getting more and more narrowly focused in on what you do well. It brings you energy. It's what you love. And it's what nobody else can do. Like, you know, like you, it's the best thing you do. And over time you're delegating more and more and more so that you're left with just the very essence of what you do. And what I've found is that quest is a mountain without a top. You're always working to just get more and more specialized in what you do very best. And so there's a couple of exercises that I talk about in the book that I recommend to leaders and any individual, because I mentioned earlier, you kind of have to reinvent yourself as you go through this. And one exercise is called the ICE exercise. And I learned some of these principles from Dan Sullivan, but I practiced it in a little different way over time. And the ICE exercise is to lay out, to write down all the things that you do. Look at your calendar, look at everything that takes your time related to work. Talk to your assistant or team members, make sure, you know, once you've got a list, and make sure that everything's on there. And then you look at it and you just label everything. I am incompetent at this. C, I'm competent. And E, I'm excellent at it. And then the whole game is to get rid of the stuff that you're incompetent at, and then get rid of the stuff that you're competent at, and only do the things that you excel at. And when you use that approach, what happens is if a business is growing fast, you've got to do this process about every 6 months. If you're growing somewhere between 50 and 100%, you can probably do it once a year. But if you're doubling the business very quickly, you know, you've got to be reinventing yourself all the time and doing an ICE exercise and redefining who you are at work. And so that's one exercise. And then the other exercise is there's so much stuff we do that we don't need to do. And I call it the 5 D's. And the 5 D's are first, and this is more for when you're overwhelmed or when you're just cluttered with a bunch of stuff. But the first D is dump everything out of your mind onto paper. The second D is delete things that you actually don't need to be done. If you stop and slow it down, you realize you do a bunch of stuff only because you've always done it. So you get rid of some stuff on the list. And then the next thing is you defer. Yes, it needs to be done, but it doesn't need to be done now. And then the fourth D is delegate. It needs to be done. It needs to be done now, but not by you. Someone else could do it. And this is where the ICE comes into play. And then the last one is do. And you only end up doing a very small percentage of the stuff that you think about, you worry about, you spend time actually taking action on. It's like, no. So those two exercises help you redefine as your role as a leader and get to where you're actually practicing the phrase, do what you do best and delegate the rest. And as you do that, you can build a team of people who are doing their unique ability. They're doing what they do best and they love doing things. And it enables you to grow a company. This is how companies grow to hundreds of employees that we have today. It's because you take something that once upon a time, only a few people did all of the things, and now you turn it into specialization and you're doing what you do. Everybody's doing what they do best and the rest is getting delegated.
Love that, man. Well, Clay, one of the last things you say in the book is keep going. I want to encourage everybody who's on this journey, keep going. Sometimes it's painful, but when it stops, I imagine it'll be way more painful. So enjoy it. Build something
going.
Healthy.
Yes.
Yeah. And build something healthy that you want to keep doing. I love the idea sort of as I don't like the concept of retirement. I love the concept of continuing to build a team that'll help me achieve my dreams. And I can do whatever part of that work or none of that work that I want to do, but still be a part of something that's, helping people achieve more. So
absolutely.
I love the idea of keep on going. I highly encourage everyone to check out the book, Conquer the Chaos. Clay, great to see you, man. Thank you so much for joining us here on Question Over.
Thanks, Nick. Great to be with you.